Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
We need to recognize the depth of this problem and make sure that we're making efforts to fight it.
That's Bethany Wattles from our January 30th edition. Dr. Wattles is a clinical pharmacist at the University of Louisville, and she was warning us that Kentuckians use a lot of antibiotics, and as a result, germs have been growing more and more resistant to them.
It's something that we need to be concerned about, and essentially, we need to fix the problem now before it's too late.
Now, we're hearing this again. As if the COVID-19 pandemic wasn't enough, there's now a warning from people working in infectious disease that another health threat is being made worse by the coronavirus crisis, and it's especially serious here in Kentucky. Joining me from Tufts Medical Center in Boston, where she is chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases, is Dr. Helen Boucher. Dr. Boucher is a board member of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, which aligns with the Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease, and it's that latter group, the partnership, that is issuing this warning. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Boucher.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first, explain for us, what is the Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease?
Well, the partnership is a new group that just launched in June, and it's born out of the Foundation for Chronic Diseases, out of the realization that patients with chronic diseases are at greater risk from infections caused by resistant bacteria and do more poorly with them. So with this recognition, groups of physicians, researchers, people who make antibiotics, and policymakers came together to advocate for greater awareness of the problem of antibiotic resistance and for solutions to ensure that we have enough antibiotics to care for our patients with resistant infections.
So, Dr. Boucher, tell us more about this red flag raised by the infectious disease community about the overuse of antibiotics.
Well, Tom, we've known that antibiotic overuse is a problem for quite a while, and a recent study shows that we still have significant antibiotic overuse all across America. It is more notable in some states, however, including yours. So that tells us that we still have work to do on educating physicians and patients on the need and the appropriate use of antibiotics.
And why the heightened sense of urgency about this as we're already grappling with COVID-19?
Well, it's a great question. And unfortunately, we have kind of the convergence of two epidemics here. So our patients with COVID-19 who are sick enough to come to the hospital are at risk of what we call secondary bacterial infections. And some of those, unfortunately, can be caused by resistant bacteria. So we're in a position where we need antibiotics to treat resistant bacteria potentially even more than ever if we want to save as many lives as possible from COVID-19. So really, truly a perfect storm in terms of two epidemics colliding.
So looking at this interactive use map, which is online at resistancemap.cddep.org, and we'll put that on our website, Kentucky is shown to have the second highest rate of antibiotics use in the entire country. Does it follow that we would also have one of the highest rates of resistance to medications used to treat infections?
Well, that's certainly a concern, Tom, and there is some evidence that that may well be the case. And so it makes it even more important to double down and focus on ways to decrease that inappropriate use and all the measures we can take to prevent resistance overall.
Have we reached the point where existing medications being used to treat related infections no longer work? Is that as dangerous as it sounds?
Well, unfortunately, in rare cases, that is true. So many of us in infectious diseases have had the sad duty of informing a patient that we did not have any other effective antibiotics to offer and having had to send those patients home on hospice. That is nothing that we as physicians ever want to have to do, and that is really motivating people like me to be here talking to you today to do everything we can to prevent this problem from getting any worse and further really potentially undermining medical care in our country.
I mentioned earlier that Kentucky has the nation's second highest rate of antibiotic use. Are antibiotics being overprescribed? Do you have data that explains why this is so?
We have some data that explains that. And so The issue is understanding if antibiotic prescription was appropriate. Certainly, if we look at studies that have been done by the CDC and others, there is evidence that there is inappropriate prescription and overprescription of antibiotics in your state and many others, really in every state. It appears to be a little more present in Kentucky. So that would suggest, again, that we have work to do on educating physicians, patients, and all of us on the need to be careful about taking antibiotics, to not ask for antibiotics when we have a cold, because that's a virus for which antibiotics don't work. And when we do take them, to take them exactly as prescribed so that we don't further exacerbate this problem.
Where is the science on this matter? Is it just a matter of coming up with yet another medication, which kind of seems like endless whack-a-mole, or are there other strategies that might work?
Well, we know that this crisis requires a multi-pronged strategy, right? We need to double down on infection prevention measures, things like washing our hands, maintaining really good environments in the hospitals and when we do procedures that have the potential to introduce infections. And it also means being ready to treat those infections that do happen, even despite our best infection control measures. The good news is that the science is there, and we've had development of several antibiotics in the past few years. Less good, however, is that the economic market is really broken and a few companies have gone bankrupt. And so that's part of our goal here at the partnership, is to advocate for policy changes that will help fix that ecosystem so that there is a stable infrastructure for antibiotic development and a market for these products to enter so that the medicines will be available to our patients as they need them.
The flu season is fast approaching. We've never been through one during a pandemic. How should we be preparing for this?
Well, we are preparing, and we all need to get involved here. So first and foremost, get your flu shot. Never been more important. And then second, we need to double down on those measures that we're all working so hard at to prevent COVID, right? Washing our hands frequently, covering our face, maintaining at least 6 feet of physical distance between anyone, ourselves and anyone with whom we don't live, and avoiding crowds. We know that these measures work, and we need to be even more vigilant as we approach the fall flu season.
On the policy side, what could lawmakers do to better prepare us against antimicrobial resistance and pandemics broadly?
Right. Well, I think the COVID epidemic has really shown us the importance of pandemic preparedness. And antibiotic resistance is here, has been here, and will be here. And it's another pandemic we need to plan for. So I think that looking at lawmakers as we look at getting ready to go to vote in a few weeks, we need investment in pandemic preparedness for antibiotic resistance, and we need to keep advocating for things like incentives for antibiotic makers to ensure that we will have those tools in our toolbox to treat infections when we encounter them.
And Dr. Boucher, I gave a URL for a specific page, but perhaps you could tell us where viewers at home can go to learn more and to take the steps they need to take to protect themselves and their families.
Right. You can go to fightinfectiousdisease.org. That's the partnership website, or idsociety.org, the Infectious Disease Society of America website, to get good information about how to protect yourself and your family during these times and really any time.
Dr. Helen Boucher is chief of the Division of Geographic Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. Thank you so much, Dr. Boucher.
Thank you.
We'll be back with part two of our conversation that began last week with UK Psychiatry Chair Seth Himmelhock about quarantine fatigue. But first, a break to give you an opportunity to become a member of WEKU and support original public radio journalism as well as all the great programming we get from NPR. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show.
We're coming up on 6 months since the coronavirus outbreak was declared a global pandemic, and a lot of us are feeling the effects of quarantine fatigue, even fatigue with terms like that. I had a long talk about that with Dr. Seth Himmelhock. He chairs the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Kentucky. You may have heard part one of our conversation on last week's edition of Eastern Standard. Here's the second half of that discussion. For young people, I'm talking about high school, college, young adults with dreams of career, romance, adventure. These have typically been the most free years of life. Can we expect that COVID restrictions will turn out to have profoundly altered this period of their lives and, as a consequence, their long-term mental well-being, mental health?
Yeah, I imagine that this will be one of those points in life where everyone will say, you know, where were you during COVID? What did you do during COVID? And people will share their experiences and, you know, how they managed to get through it. I have, two college-age daughters. Both of them are home right now doing coursework online. And one of them has already said to me that she's not planning to be, you know, at home, you know, come the spring, that she would prefer to be with her friends. And what I mean by that is, you know, if we're still living in the social distance world because COVID's a social phenomenon, we have to keep safe, that she would do that in a safe way, but live with friends as opposed to living with her parents. And to my mind, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, kids, when they're moving into the age of going to college, one of the big developmental milestones, of course, is independence, learning how to be an adult, how to take care of oneself, how to manage all the things that one needs to do during the course of life. So in some ways, you know, having college-age students be at home can have a negative impact for them. They can feel it as being stifling or not as helpful. And so what I would say is certainly for some who are experiencing not going back to college, this could be impactful in that way. For those who are going back to college, they may be feeling the freedom and the spirit and all that, but may also be feeling the confinement that the appropriate social distancing and mask wearing and all that that needs to take place requires. So again, it's a very, very challenging time. I do think that people are, resilient, and especially younger adults are probably very resilient. And my hope is that this will just be a point in time where people look back and say, you know, what were you doing during COVID? But again, there's always people who may be at risk. And for those who are feeling symptomatic or feeling the symptoms that I've talked about earlier, it's really, really important to get help sooner than later. And help is there for those people.
What about sociable people, people who thrive on being in the company of others, but are now isolated and envious of people who have more than the cats to talk to? are introverts better equipped than extroverts? I would call those folks extroverts to handle these COVID conditions.
Yeah. Speaking as an introvert, introversion, is one way in which people deal with the outside world, the energy in the world. And for introverts, being in the world requires a lot of energy. So being isolated or being by themselves or only with a core group of friends, potentially is an easier situation than a person who's an extrovert who their energy level gets increased by social interaction. So my guess just anecdotally would be that, introverts would do better given the social distancing and requirements that we live in under COVID than extroverts. I don't know that there's any studies that have looked at this per se to see whether or not introverts do better than extroverts on a variety of outcome measures. But just from my own understanding of how these behaviors work and how people might negotiate, isolation, it would seem to me that introverts might do better than extroverts. But again, that's just my own personal opinion, and it's not based on any evidence.
Melancholy is defined as feeling a pensive sadness. And for those of us who like to put a name on whatever it is that's bothering us, Would melancholy be appropriate? What are some coping mechanisms for melancholy?
Yeah. So melancholy is a important word. It's meant a more severe depression. And for clinicians in the mental health world, melancholy is a subset of major depression. And it's usually connected to certain symptoms, such as, you know, early morning awakening, not feeling like you have a lot of energy, feeling very depressed all day, every day, not getting any benefit at all from pleasurable activities, and then having particular concerns with eating, not eating enough or eating too much, sleeping, either sleeping too much or not sleeping enough, and then a lack of energy. But I think the point that you're making is that melancholy can be a substitute word for depression, and there are ways in which people can get help for depressive symptoms. And one of the most beneficial ways is something called behavioral activation, which is just a fancy word for doing fun activities. And behavioral activation or doing fun activities has a very strong evidence base and is maybe one of the strongest antidepressants that we have. And the way it works is if people are feeling like down or blue, one of the easiest ways for them to kind of pick themselves back up is to begin to schedule things that they really enjoy doing into the routine. So if someone really enjoys watching, you know, funny movies on TV but hasn't been doing that, that might be a good thing to schedule in to begin to bring enjoyment back into life. Another example might be, taking time to meditate or spending time, journaling, things that, again, draw you deeper to yourself and your own inquiry. Finally, I would say that making sure that people are taking care of themselves just in general. So, you know, eating right, sleeping enough, making sure that if they have a medical illness, that they're attending to those medical illnesses, and then staying physically fit through exercise. All these things can do a lot to help prevent depressive symptoms. And if people beginning to have depressive symptoms, it can help prevent them from getting worse or even remove them altogether.
Here's another word. The ancient Greeks had a word for the lack of self-control, akrasia, acting against one's better judgment because of a weakness of will. And they say it's what happens when we succumb to a temptation that feels good in the moment rather than doing something that would be good for us in the long run. And so during this pandemic, that might include binging Netflix for hours instead of doing our work, succumbing to our emotions and snapping at loved ones or even strangers, or maybe endlessly doom-scrolling the news. How can we prevent ourselves from succumbing to akrasia?
I think first I would say that I'm not sure this is a lack of will on anyone's part. Sometimes under stress, people can, you know, have behaviors that may feel outside of their control. And it's important to understand that. And if people are feeling that way, again, that's another, you know, sign of one might need to get more help. So the obvious answer to me is, and this may seem simple, is don't doom scroll, right? That's not going to be helpful in the moment. But the truth is that sometimes the power to do it is so great that just saying no is not going to be enough, obviously. And again, if that's the case, getting more help is going to be what's necessary for that person. And it does dovetail into other behaviors, such as, you know, sometimes people start doing things that are more impulsive. And if they are doing more impulsive things that may not be in line with the normal behavior that they're doing, then I would say, again, those can be symptomatic triggers to say one may need more help. So I would shy away a little bit from the idea of lack of will, or because sometimes these things under stress can start developing a life of their own. And I would just say that if people are experiencing them and it's concerning them or concerning their friends or loved ones, that could be a real sign of needing help. And again, help is here if people need it.
Have you witnessed any positive effects clinically of the quarantine? And what are the markers of positive coping and resiliency?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because we've been spending a lot of time, obviously, talking about the negative sequelae of stress and how stress can result or lead to more burdensome negative symptoms, but we haven't really spent time talking about the positive side as much. And I would just say that there is great opportunity in stressful times. Sometimes stressful situations lead to great innovation. People get incredibly creative. Ingenuity comes to bear and leads to all sorts of new things that we haven't considered in the past about how we can communicate, how we can live, and how we can do things better. And it also offers the opportunity for the community to work together. And sometimes, you know, we can really see ourselves as just individuals, and we may not feel as connected to a larger community. And I would say that this is an opportunity for people to imagine being connected to a larger community and helping others where they can, getting connected to causes that they think are important, and doing things for others where they may have not had the time or energy in the past because they were commuting or getting their kids back and forth to school or things like that. So if time is opening up, this may be an opportunity for people to fill that time with positive activities.
You know, I think that we have set up the prospect of a vaccine within the next year, maybe, as something of a holy grail. And I'm wondering if we can expect many of the traumas that we've been talking about, many of the conditions that we've been talking about, be they mental or emotional, will fade or even end with the advent of a vaccine.
A lot of people have been talking about this, that the COVID pandemic might be followed by a mental health epidemic. And as you can see, we've been talking about many of the negative sequelae of the high stress that's occurring in our society right now. And it's you know, the symptoms are real. When you look at cross-sectional surveys that have been done in different areas in the world or even in America, the burden of symptoms that people are reporting are quite high. So there's something real going on, and people are really feeling it. And the question is, what is that going to look like, you know, 5 or 6 months or even a year from now as we continue moving through the pandemic and the social distancing or the social phenomena that I've been talking about that's connected to COVID-19. And I think that we really don't know what's going to happen. Will the balance tip toward like the negative side where people are more symptomatic and require more mental health treatment in order to help them feel more stable and more connected to their day-to-day routines? Or will it shift more to the resilient side and people will see this as an opportunity to able to convert some of the stress into things that can, you know, make the society better, or make themselves better, or make themselves, allow themselves to feel more connected? I really don't know which direction we'll go in, but I do know that if our community doesn't prepare for it, we may find ourselves in a very similar situation that we did at the beginning of COVID, maybe not as prepared as we had liked to have been to meet the challenge that COVID brought to our communities. And I would just say that this is a time for all of us to really think about how do we want to see behavioral health implemented in our communities over the next maybe 6 to 12 months in order to ensure that if there is a increase of symptoms or increase in need for people, that we'll be able to meet that need with grace and you know, true acknowledgement that people really need the care that they deserve.
Dr. Seth Himmelhoff, Chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Tom, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to share this really important issue with your audience.
We'll be back with Future Tense, Chris Begley, and Lexington chef and community activist Dan Wu on how the local restaurant industry is fighting for its life.
In the past, you know, you may have worked for, you know, sustainability in restaurant sourcing. Now, we're just trying to keep restaurants open. We're trying to keep people paid.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. Chris Begley is back with our Future Tense series of conversations about life during and beyond this pandemic.
I'm excited to welcome today Dan Wu, chef, owner of Atomic Ramen, a community activist and organizer in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So here on Future Tense, we're talking about where we are, where we're going in the pandemic and post-pandemic world. And one of the things all of us have experienced and thought about and heard about is the effect of all of this on local businesses, you know, on our favorite restaurants, on our favorite bars or art galleries. I wanted to ask you, as a restaurant owner, as a business owner, where are we in all of this? Do you see it getting better, getting worse? Where is it headed?
I can tell you it's been bad for half a year, and I'm honestly really afraid that it's going to get worse. We're hit by kind of a combination, 1-2 punch. Is the restaurant industry in general doesn't have wide margins. So anytime there's bad weather or there's a ball game on and you don't have a TV in your bar or any sort of little hiccup, it can really hit your bottom line. But with just revenues absolutely tanking, with stay-at-home orders, with people staying away from restaurants, and all the capacity restrictions by different states, it hits our bottom line really, really hard. The other part of it that makes it even worse is we don't have any sort of timeline or any way to project to the future. And when you can't plan for the future as a small business, you lose money because you can't use your money efficiently. You can't hire with the expectation, you know, like Keeneland's coming up or there's basketball season, so you can know, oh, I have to hire more and I have to make more food because I have this expectation that the business will shift. You have no expectation right now of anything. And on top of it, you know, restaurants have gone from closed to curbside and pickup only to 33% to 50% to 25% back to 50%. Bars now have to close at 10. I mean, it's whiplash, and it's really bad out there. And I don't know that I have any good news in that respect.
Yeah. And these sort of efforts to keep things going with the curbside service or the delivery service, to what degree has that been successful?
I think, honestly, you know, all of my friends in the industry are trying their best to literally come up with anything that will keep them in business. And you see so many restaurants that are primarily sit-down restaurants or even fine dining restaurants kind of bending over backwards to figure out the curbside and then building out patios, buying or renting, you know, big event tents in their parking lots, turning parking spaces into curbside spaces or dining spaces, buying tables, buying chairs, buying umbrellas. They're literally doing everything they can think of to continue. And nobody I know is doing anywhere close to the revenue that they're supposed to be. Everybody I know is doing maybe 25 to 50% of their normal revenue. And, you know, it's not sustainable. At some point, the money will run out. And we've already seen a lot of local businesses shuttering. And I fear that we're going to see an acceleration of that.
When you think about the response to the pandemic, and I'm talking about the response from the government, but also response from just citizens, people out there. Does it seem appropriate to you in terms of what we've done? Could we have done something better, or what would you like to see happen?
You know, in a perfect world where we had a lot of foresight and we had a lot of collective will, what should have happened from the early stages is a much harder lockdown than what we had, like just shut everything down. Now, you can't shut everything down and just let people, you know, to their own devices. You have to basically replace their income, replace their salary, replace the revenue that these businesses are generating so that they can keep the lights on, keep people on payroll, keep the rent paid. But because we didn't do that, we did this kind of weird half measure where we're like sort of open, sort of closed. Certain things are open, certain things are closed with restrictions. So we're kind of doing semi-business as usual with not very much help from the federal government. And it just became kind of unsustainable. With that said, I've for the most part, agreed and appreciated our governor, Beshear's efforts to take this seriously. We've seen a lot of other states where they haven't taken it seriously, and they have way bigger outbreaks and way bigger infection spikes. So I appreciate everything he's doing, but at the same time, from the state level, he can only do so much. Like, we need a lot of support from the federal level in terms of money, and we need just a coordinated federal response. When the White House says we're going to leave the pandemic response to the states, well, you're going to get this patchwork. Imagine if you had a roach problem in your house and you only sprayed 2 of the 5 rooms. What does that do? I mean, you're not going to get rid of the problem in the entire house because you're connected, just as the United States is connected. So, you know, that to me is the government side of it. From the sort of the population, from the people side of it, it's been very frustrating because I would say by and large, a lot of Americans are taking it seriously, taking precautions, wearing masks, distancing, limiting their social activities. But you have this whole sort of cultural backlash against all of this that's based on anti-science, based on this kind of warped view of personal freedom. And it just makes things so much harder. There's so much disinformation out there. So it's very frustrating to think that my family and I can do everything 100% right in terms of staying safe, and we could still get sick because of some random person we encounter out in the world who isn't taking it seriously. So it's frustrating.
And looking at the numbers, in some ways, we're back to square one.
Yeah, yeah. And here's the frustrating part. We're back not only to square one, we're back to worse than square one. We're back to worse than where we were in March and April. But with the added fatigue of people who, you know, justifiably miss seeing their friends and family, small business owners who haven't had real revenue in months, so they're trying to be open. You know, I sometimes see reports of, you know, businesses not getting with the mandates and sort of conducting business in what looks like an unethical way. And there's a part of me that can't blame them because they're probably starving for revenue or they're not able to pay their rent. So they're trying to figure this out. So we're being forced to a lot of like really difficult decisions right now.
Yeah. Now, I know one of the things you do also is a lot of community activism, community organizing. And I know that you're involved right now in a few different efforts to do things of that nature. You've had your Facebook Live show for a while now called Let's Get Through This that dealt with what's happening here in Lexington. I know that you're also involved in a number of efforts to find community-based solutions to some of these issues. And I wondered if you could tell me a little about that and what are some of the issues that you see as urgently needing addressing?
Yeah, I mean, the one good thing that comes out of these sort of situations, especially when you're not getting support from a governmental or sort of official level, federal or otherwise, is you see a lot of just the citizens, like the people of your community stepping up and taking on those roles in very much a mutual aid kind of way, which I think is amazing and very encouraging. So, you know, as many issues and as many interests and goals as we have for the community, right now, the pandemic has laid bare economic inequities in race and class, in money. And the things that we're focusing in on now are really bare necessity stuff. Like, you know, in the past, you know, you may have worked for, you know, sustainability in restaurant sourcing. Now we're just trying to keep restaurants open. We're trying to keep people paid. So I've been part of some efforts to create feeding centers in Lexington. We did that with Lex Unite and the Lee Initiative, where we gave out tens of thousands of meals to people who needed them. And then we've been pushing to get the Senate to look at the HEROES Act, and that's been on Mitch McConnell's desk for 3 months. I don't know if that's happening. And the latest thing I'm working on is with the Independent Restaurant Coalition trying to push through Congress a $120 billion basically stimulus/rescue grant package for the restaurant industry. It's $120 billion in grants, not loans. The PPP loans came out a while ago, and it was not nothing, but the industry needs a lot more than that because we employ so many millions of people. So right now, I'm kind of back to basics in terms of just making sure that our small businesses survive and our employees can continue getting a paycheck.
And it seems that your efforts are really split between the local hands-on, you know, person-to-person sort of issues and also dealing with the policies or the legislative issues that would have a broader impact.
Yeah, that's right. What's interesting is, you know, for me as a small business owner, I'm all about the ROI. I'm all about the return on investment. So when you do things in the local community, let's say something as small as helping somebody pay their electrical bill, you can make a big impact to that one individual with not a lot of investment, right? An electric bill may be $50, but and it's an easier lift and it's very doable, but your impact is also small. It's small on a grand scale of things. And then you're trying to get, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to pass a bill that would impact the entire United States and a multi-million dollar, a billion-dollar industry. That's a huge lift, and obviously not one person can do it. That's why we've been working in coordination with IRC and tons of other people, so many, like every restaurateur in every state in America, from celebrities to just everyday, you know, restaurants. So in some ways, you kind of have to do both. Like if I were just working on these sort of national policy issues, sometimes it would be pretty dispiriting because of how little impact I as an individual can have with my efforts. So I think you definitely can and have to do both.
And thinking about moving forward, where we're going from here, are there certain things that you're enthusiastic about or hopeful about that has come from all of this?
That's such a tough question. I mean, I'm generally a hopeful person. And I think for a lot of people right now, like we've had 5 months of this, and I read an article recently talking about our surge energy has ebbed because that energy that you get through a short-term emergency, this is not a short-term emergency, and we also don't know when it will end, if it'll get worse. So we're all tapped out right now. So my wellspring of hope feels pretty low. What gets me through the day is the idea that there are plenty of people like myself who are wanting to help their community and realizing that in order to get out of this individually or as just a small business owner, we have to do it collectively, that we have an immense amount of power when we work together, either for advocacy or just for boots on the ground, mutual aid type work, that we can't necessarily rely on the powers that be or lawmakers or our leaders, you know, our official leaders, that we kind of have to take this stuff into our own hands. So that part gives me hope. And what we need is organization and resources.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. This has been a conversation with Dan Wu, chef, owner of Atomic Ramen, community activist and organizer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Rebecca Henchett retired in June from the Legislative Research Commission in Frankfurt, where she was Assistant Public Information Officer and Public Affairs Specialist. Now she's moving on with an online project called Untucked. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm really good. And what is Untucked?
Untucked is a blog about those unexpected or underappreciated experiences that Kentucky has to offer. When I retired from state government, I started writing it and wanted to continue with my writing career through a different vein and decided to try my hand at blogging. Since then, I've been to 7 counties and counting with Untucked.
So is that part of it? You're going to be traveling all around Kentucky, or are you also looking for input from people out there that might have an unusual story or something unexpected that they could send along to you?
I would love input. I'd love input and company on these blog trips.
And what kind of, give us an example of the kind of unusual thing that we might find on Untucked.
It's turned into a travel blog so far with a lot of history. Of course, Kentucky is the oldest state outside of New England and the Atlantic seaboard, so there's a ton of history here. Exploring that history in a blog interested me, not because of what I already knew about my native state, and I am a native Kentuckian, but because of what I don't know. I've lived in the Commonwealth my entire life, but I haven't always paid attention to much of the history and experiences in my own backyard. And there's a lot to see. For example, what I've found so far, when I went to Perryville in Boyle County, I noticed a marker on Merchants Row, which is in downtown Perryville. And it was about hatchet-wielding temperance leader Carrie Nation. I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of her. And she was a terrifying figure, dressed in black with her hatchet, smashing up bars and barrels during Prohibition throughout the Midwest. But not everyone knows that she was born in Garrard County, Kentucky. She was born in Garrard County in 1846 and lived for a while on Merchants Row as a child. So that was, you know, an interesting piece of history that I uncovered.
So if somebody knows of a story like that and they think it is unknown or kind of unexpected, how can they get in touch with you to share the information?
They can email me through the website. There is a contact form page on the website, which is www.theun-tucked.com. And I will respond readily to them. And we can talk about what they've seen and what they know and what I should know and what the rest of Kentucky should know.
Okay, Rebecca, this is going to be fun to watch. We'll check back with you in about 6 months or so and see how it's grown, okay?
Wonderful.
That's Rebecca Hanchett, founder of theun-tucked.com. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. Your ideas are welcome. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.